This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
Welcome to the show. Dr. Zane with me, Dr. Denosa Archer. Good night, producer. We're getting a little feedback, so whatever you can do, let me know. Welcome, everyone, to Guardian Radio 96.9. We are live on the air tonight, and you're here with me, Dr. Denosa Archer Cartwright, family medicine specialist. We talk about all things health, wellness, and things that pertain to the Bahamian society, so welcome to the show. Of course, brought to you tonight by Medical Concierge Services for all your medical health needs. You can check us on Facebook and Instagram, of course. And tonight we have a special guest with us. We're going to kind of do two topics tonight, but we're going to get started on a topic because it is Kidney Month. So we're talking all things kidney for the beginning of our show. And I have a special guest. I've known her since I was studying medical at UE in the Bahamas. And she was one of those who was really tough on us, but she was excellent, helped us become the doctors that we are today. So I have a special pleasure to welcome, I think for the first time, Dr. Ilse Grant Taylor. Welcome to the show, Doctor.
Good evening, and thank you, Denotra. I did not know I was tough. I learned something tonight.
Yeah, you were tough, but in a good way. You know, I think all of the doctors that we came in with were, you know, those doctors that made sure that you knew what you were doing. So we were confident when we were off by ourselves. So tough in a good way and in a way that we need for structure, you know? So I think it was a blessing.
I'm happy to hear that.
But welcome to the show. We're talking about Kidney Month. You're representing the Kidney Center, you're going to tell us all about chronic kidney disease. So before we kind of go into the activities and everything that's happening, just let us know a little bit about you and a little bit about chronic kidney disease and how they work. If you don't know, Dr. Grant is a internist and also a nephrologist. So she is the doctor that specializes in your kidneys. So she knows all about kidney disease. So Dr. Grant, give us a little idea about what kidney disease is and why we need to be aware.
Okay. So we are going to start right at the very beginning. And everybody knows that the kidneys produce urine. But that's not the only job of the kidneys. The kidneys are one of the two detoxifying organs in the body, the other one being the liver. And so the kidney is responsible for helping the body clear the toxins. But it has a lot of other jobs. It also helps with water balance. And so people may note that if they drink a lot of water, they pass a lot of urine. And if they don't drink a lot of water, they don't pass as much urine. They have a very good functioning kidney as far as water balance. The unknown jobs of the kidney are that it helps with bone metabolism and calcium metabolism. It's responsible for helping the body absorb calcium. And we all know that the bones and the teeth are two organs that need calcium, but calcium is also helpful in the electric circuitry of the body to help with the heartbeat and the nerve transmission. And another important job of the kidney is to help make red blood cells. It produces a hormone called erythropoietin that helps the body make hemoglobin and red blood cells to carry oxygen around the body. So in my opinion, and I think some of my other colleagues would not agree, but I think the kidney is the most important organ in the body.
And that is always the debate, right? The cardiologists, nephrologists, everybody thinks, those organs, but they're all very important. And you pointed out a lot of interesting things about the kidney that I think a lot of people don't realize how much the kidneys really do. They only think about the urine production, but you made some great points about what the other functions of the kidney really is.
That's correct. It has a lot of very vital functions. And like any other organ in the body, when one of your organs don't work and you go into organ failure, you can die. So it has a very, very, very important function. When it's failing, we need to know urgently and replace the job of the kidney with that dreaded word, dialysis.
And that is a fair. We only know the end of the story, but it does take a lot to kind of get there.
That is correct.
So how do we get to, what is chronic kidney disease in a sense, so people have an idea, and then we can go into why we all need to know about this?
Okay. I like that question. And our theme for the year for Kidney Week is bridging the knowledge gap. So that's going to be one of our main objectives tonight, I trust. Mm-hmm. So chronic kidney disease is, the best way to say it is long-standing kidney disease versus acute kidney disease, which is a short episodic event. And the formal definition of chronic kidney disease is an estimated GFR of less than 60 mLs per minute per 1.73 meters squared. And that's very complicated.
Yeah, so break that down for our audience so they're aware when they hear those types of things.
Right. So the best way to do it is to label it as a percent, because somebody who has approximately 100 mLs per minute of function is functioning normally. So how I try to describe it is, if your kidney is functioning at less than 60%, then you have chronic kidney disease. But that's the simplest definition. You also have chronic kidney disease if you have any kind of problem with your kidney. Say you were born with one kidney, then by the definition, you have chronic kidney disease. If you have kidney stones, but your kidney is functioning normally, you still have chronic kidney disease. If you're born with some kind of problem with your bladder and your urinary system, the kidneys function normally, but because you have an anatomical problem, you still have chronic kidney disease. And there's a familial condition that's called polycystic kidneys. So if you have cysts in your kidneys, but they function normally, you also have chronic kidney disease. Then we can look at the urine. If you are spilling protein or blood in your urine, even if your kidneys function normally, you are thought to have chronic kidney disease. So the definition goes from the very plain, having less than 60%, to the more subtle and more nuanced definition that your doctor will say, Mr. Brown, Mr. Smith, Ms. Brown, I see you keep having protein in your urine. There's a problem with your kidney, and that person would also be defined as having chronic kidney disease.
Okay, yeah, you really kind of explained that really well. And you talked about some people, you know, having naturally or born with issues with their kidney, but we do have those people that acquire kidney disease. Can you expand to the audience some of the risk factors, some of the things that might lead to someone having chronic kidney disease?
Well, in our society, and in the whole world, the number one cause of kidney problems is diabetes mellitus. So diabetics are at the highest risk of having chronic kidney disease. Next is persons with hypertension or high blood pressure. they are also at risk of having chronic kidney disease. So they're at definitely the top of the pile. And then after them, lots and lots of other persons. Persons who are obese are at risk of kidney disease. People who smoke are at risk of kidney disease. People who have ischemic heart disease or coronary heart disease are at risk for chronic kidney disease. Persons with elevated cholesterol are at risk for chronic kidney disease. And then we have the persons, like you say, who acquire kidney disease through another disease. Persons who have lupus or collagen vascular disease, they're also at risk for kidney disease. Persons who have the blood disorder sickle cell disease, they're also at risk for chronic kidney disease. And then we have the familial conditions such as polycystic kidney disease, Alport syndrome, IgA nephropathy. These are all very complicated names, but these tend to be inherited diseases. And then we also have a group of diseases called glomerulonephritis, which means that there's a inflammation of the working unit, the glomerulus, and it causes the person to either spill protein or blood and protein. And we haven't proven it, but I think that we have the gene for a condition called focal segmental glomerulosclerosis in our society. Mm-hmm. And so that's a genetic reason why people develop a kidney problem. Yeah. And so those are the big highlighted areas for kidney disease.
So there's a lot of space in there for kidney disease. It's no wonder it's such an impact on our society. Just reading from your information here, it talks about kidney disease becoming the fifth leading cause of death by 2040. Your theme for the month, Kidney Health for All, Bridge the Knowledge Gap to Better Kidney Care. Why choose that theme, and why should we be aware as a community of kidney disease and its kind of complications?
So we are now in an era where persons are dying from non-communicable diseases. And I say that kind of hesitantly because, of course, the COVID-19 was a communicable disease.
Right.
But I feel that we're now, and statistics have shown that this pandemic is starting, and I'm knocking on wood here, starting to wane. So barring the coronavirus pandemic, we now have non-communicable diseases. And those diseases, if not managed, can lead to organ problems such as heart disease, kidney disease, that kind of thing. And so all of the non-communicable diseases are best managed with preventive measures, with getting ahead of the ball and not letting the horse get out of the barn. And kidney disease is in that same boat. So if we can get persons educated and aware and move them from that phase to being more active about being as healthy as possible, that should do the trick. And we can bridge that knowledge gap in that way. Early diagnosis and as many preventative measures as possible, as early as possible.
Yes, I totally agree, especially, you know, from family medicine, we do like to focus a lot on the preventative side of it. And working with doctors like yourself, subspecialists, to kind of make sure people don't really get to the, you know, the end of that prognosis really, really bad. And early diagnosis is extremely important, especially in my field. So working and coordinating with doctors like Dr. Grant Taylor is extremely important for the health of the nation, because nobody wants to end up on dialysis, but we know that your kidney disease can be managed in many cases, correct?
You are absolutely correct. So let's roll back a little bit and let's talk about CKD. So we talked about this magic 60%.
Mm-hmm.
So at 60%, you're felt to be in stage 3 of chronic kidney disease, and there are 5 stages. Most persons tend to be diagnosed at stage 3. And so if we can as a healthcare providers, if we can catch persons maybe a little earlier than stage three, then we could do a better job, I think. But stage three is the stage where things are starting to tip. You know, that's the tipping point.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get to less than 30%, you're at stage four. And when you're getting to stage four, it's very advanced. And sometimes there's not a lot of stabilization or improvement at stage four. The best we can hope for persons in stage four is to stabilize. And then when you get to less than 15%, you're at stage five. And then we have to talk about replacing the job of the kidney, which is the formal name for dialysis. Dialysis is considered a renal replacement therapy, where the job of the kidney is replaced with dialysis, but not all the jobs.
Yeah. And, you know, dialysis is kind of like us just trying to do as much as we can to keep the processes, because you talked about all those important things that the kidney does. And dialysis does like really like one of, well, some of the main jobs, but not everything. There's a lot of supplemental other things that have to be done, medication and different stuff, if someone is really at the end stage of kidney disease. And so catching it early really seems to be the best way to slow that prognosis. You talk about the knowledge gaps that exist. Where do you feel like we have these gaps, and what can we do to kind of fill those?
So I have been reading the literature that came out from the World Kidney Day Organization, and they talk about the gaps being in three places: with the community, with healthcare workers, and with public policymakers. And I agree with that. I think that we'll get the most bang for the buck with trying to educate and close the gap in the community. I think if persons are aware of the profound effect of kidney disease and the profound effect on their kidneys of high blood pressure, diabetes, sickle cell disease, obesity, then we can make some headway and we can kind of get some inertia so that we can then get more healthcare workers, I would want to say, tuned up. I don't want to say that they don't know. I just think it needs to come to the forefront. You know, they need to think about kidney health a little bit more. And then I think as we get this engine rolling, then we can make some inroads with the policymakers. But I think it has to start on the ground with the community, with the patients, with their caretakers. And I also think with the young people, the little children mm-hmm. in school.
Yeah.
We have to start, you know, we have to bend the tree when it's young.
Definitely. Starting early is the key. And I think we need to get in there more. And as a family physician, I always advocate that we should be out there educating our students about all these health issues so that when they're adults, they have a better understanding and they already have this healthier lifestyle incorporated into their life. Now, you guys have a lot of events. You have some events planned for CKD month. What kind of things that are you guys doing to make the community aware and you're continuing your education throughout the month?
Well, we are very COVID conscious. And so most of our activities are along the lines of what we're doing now. We're involved in a lot of talk shows, TV specials, TV spots. And then we're having a webinar on Sunday, the 20th of March. And there's also the Bahamas Kidney Association. They're having a webinar. And so each organization is having different fora for the public to interact in a safe way. So as far as Kidney Center Limited is concerned, we're not doing any interactive mm-hmm. events for the public. We have a few events for our patients, but the interactive event for the general public is going to be the webinar on the 20th, Sunday the 20th mm-hmm. at 5:00 in the afternoon. And there's a registration link through our Facebook page.
Okay.
Called Renal House.
Renal House. So they just look up Renal House on Facebook. They'll be able to get to that link and be able to join in on that webinar.
Right, on that Sunday afternoon.
On Sunday
afternoon. The why on a Sunday. Mm-hmm. In the dialysis world, Sunday is our only day off. We dialyze Monday, Wednesdays, and Fridays, or Tuesday, Thursdays, and Saturdays. So Sunday is a day that we're all going to be available to participate in this event. So you're going to get information from physicians, from nursing, from our social work team. The whole interdisciplinary team is going to discuss our theme, Bridge the Knowledge Gap to Better Kidney Care.
That's awesome. I'm glad that you are expanding that webinar for the entire community so that they can get a lot more information on what's going on with Kidney Month and just information in general that we all need to know to make our lives better. Can you just give us, before we kind of wrap up, some things that can maybe lower a person's risk if they, or what they should do if they think they might have kidney disease?
Okay. Thank you for that great question. The first thing that everybody has to do is they have to have a healthcare provider. We have to start at the very basics. When you speak with a lot of patients, you find that they haven't been continuously following up on their health. So the idea of having a healthcare provider and having some kind of regular examination, having your blood pressure checked, your glucose checked, your urine checked, having some, having somebody look at you properly, make sure your weight is good. So I think we have to start at the very beginning with our patients seeking healthcare, just the most basic. Even if you don't feel bad, still go and have a physical. And then when we do diagnose a problem, don't run away. Let's get a proper diagnosis. Let's get a proper treatment. And so we have a lot of persons who find out they have, say, high blood pressure. And they have a concept that they want to do it naturally, that they don't want to use pills. And then we never see them anymore until they've had some untoward event, such as a stroke, such as a heart attack, such as becoming blind. And so I think we want to catch our population before that point. So develop a relationship with a healthcare practitioner. If you have a problem, follow with your healthcare practitioner, partner with them, and try and get normalized on whatever treatment you decide. As I've told a lot of my patients, it's very difficult to control blood pressure. That's gone too far with just natural means. If you have very, very mild blood pressure, sometimes dietary measures, sometimes botanicals, for want of a better word, may help. But once your blood pressure's past a certain degree, you need medications. And you need to take them lifelong, and you need to control the blood pressure because we don't want the complications, the heart failure, the strokes, the kidney disease. So I think that's where we start.
Yeah, I think that's really great advice. Prevention is key, and you're absolutely correct. A lot of people wait very late, and then they want to correct it with, non-traditional medication and, different things. And it's almost a little bit too late. So catching it early, especially if you want to stay off of medication and lifestyle, is going to be the key for everyone. So what are your take-home messages for the public? What do you really want them to know? And give us that information again so that people can sign in for the webinar on the weekend.
So the one thing that we did forget to discuss is Thursday. Thursday, the 10th of March, is World Kidney Day.
Ah, there you go. So
we have
official kidney day.
But we actually even have a day.
Yes.
So Thursday is World Kidney Day. And so we're going to be really having a blitz on that particular day. So that's one of the take-home messages, that Thursday is World Kidney Day.
Should they be doing anything special? Are there any ribbons or anything? What should be anything that people should kind of just do additionally on that day?
Our traditional color is green. So maybe going green on World Kidney Day would be a good idea. The second thing is that I want everybody to take a long, hard look at themselves and say, I'm going to get myself in better health. And whatever that takes, whether that takes changing your diet, getting rid of sweetened beverages, cutting out the fast food habit, not telling your friend, no, I'm not going for that walk this morning, your walking buddy, getting enough sleep. I want everybody to be focused on better health habits. Young people, older people, everybody. And then the group of persons who have non-communicable diseases such as diabetes and hypertension, I want them to go to the tablets. I want them to set them up, take them every day. If they have a glucometer, I want them to check their glucose more than they were doing before. I want persons who have high blood pressure, who have a blood pressure machine, I want them to check it a little bit more often and write it down. I want women to make sure they have their mammograms, their pap smears. I want males to make sure that once they get past the age of 40 or so, that they have their PSA and their rectal exam done. I want everybody to start to develop healthy habits. And because healthy habits lead to healthy kidneys. And then we wanted to talk about the webinar that's on Sunday, March the 20th. And it can be accessed through Facebook. And the page is Renal House, RENALHOUSE.
So I hope everybody got that. I want you to go to Renal House's page on Facebook and check out and look where the link is and put that in your schedules so that you can be a part of that webinar and get the great information that you're going to get from Dr. Grant and her team. This is wonderful information. It's been a pleasure to have Dr. Grant here. Dr. Grant is the top of her field, and she knows exactly what she's talking about. So if you want to know about kidney disease, definitely she is the person that you would want to speak with. So it's been a pleasure speaking with you, Dr. Grant. I want to thank you for coming on the show. I loved having you. I think you made some very interesting points and highlighted how important preventative medicine is in all of this and the progression of the disease state. So thank you for being with us tonight on The Doctor's Inn, and we hope to see you again because this is always going to be a pleasure for us.
Thank you for having me, and I'm always open to returning.
Wonderful. I want you to have a really good night, and once again, everybody, check out Renal House's page on Facebook, and I want you to put that webinar into your calendar, and just tell us the date one more time before you head out.
Sunday, March 20th.
Awesome. Great. Great to have you, Dr. Grant Taylor. Have a good night.
Okay. Thank you.
Wow. Yes, everybody, you heard Dr. Grant Taylor. She was our nephrologist on for tonight, our specialist, our kidney specialist, talking about the importance of kidney disease. And it is Kidney Month. And of course, the 10th is specifically the National Kidney Day. So please participate in that webinar. We're going to take a quick break and we're going to come right back and we're going to talk a little bit about the glycemic index and some of the foods that are high versus low. So we'll be back on The Doctor's Inn with me, Dr. D. Archer, in just a moment. Thank you.
That's right. We deliver savings directly to you.
It's never been easier for Family Island customers to shop a variety of club products and prices right from home. Simply call or email your order to have one of our friendly staff pick, pack, and deliver your order to the mailboat today. Place your order now at 677-7266 or email order@amlfoods.com. Don't have a membership card? Join today for even more savings. CostRite, we're all about delivering savings directly to you.
Always on the go? Missed a show? You can now listen to Guardian Radio talk shows anytime, anywhere on Spotify and YouTube by searching Guardian Radio 96.9 FM or by entering the name of your favorite show. You can also listen by logging on to guardiantalkradio.com and clicking on the podcast tab. Guardian Radio, continuing to provide you with fresh news and smart talk anywhere, anytime, all day.
This is Guardian Radio 96.9 FM. Fresh news, smart talk, all day.
Welcome back to The Doctor Is In with me, Dr. Dinothra Archer-Cartwright. So if you were listening before, we had Dr. Ilsa Grant Taylor on with us, internist and nephrologist, one of our leading doctors in kidneys and kidney disease. And she was telling us about Kidney Month and also Kidney Day on the 10th. March is Kidney Month. And she does have a webinar that's going on. Go to the Renal House Facebook page and check out that link. Thank you again, Dr. Grant, for coming out tonight and being a part of the show. So of course, tonight's show brought to you by Medical Concierge Services for all your medical health needs. And just a note, the office will be closed on Friday. So if you need anything, 429-4880. We're gonna go on tonight with our second topic. We're going to talk about the glycemic index and what that is. I thought this was a really interesting topic, because we always talk about diabetes, hypertension. We don't always talk about the details of how to keep those really, really controlled. And so one of the things that has come out more recently is about the glycemic index, which pretty much gives you, is a value about food, and it tells you the food's impact on the body and the blood sugar. If you are a diabetic or a pre-diabetic, or even just someone who wants to avoid having diabetes, it's really good to have an idea of how these foods interact with your body and how they affect your levels of sugar in your body, because it is after time when you end up with insulin insensitivity that you end up developing diabetes. And these are some of the foods that create problems and also make your sugar really hard to manage. So what exactly is the glycemic index? Well, it's a relative ranking of carbohydrates, and carbohydrates are the starchy foods that are made up of the building blocks of sugar, which lead a lot of times to people having issues with their sugar and also to diabetes. So these carbohydrates affect your blood sugar, and what the glycemic index does, it ranks these food high versus low, depending on how they interact with your body. So when you have type 2 diabetes, one of the best ways to control your glucose levels is to eat foods that do not cause major blood sugar spikes. So what happens in the body is you intake food, you intake sugars, you release insulin, and the insulin tries to bring the sugar levels down. But when you have foods that cause really high spikes, you need a lot of insulin, and that's how you end up developing insensitivity. So what you want to do is you want to have foods that are going to bring up your sugar levels extremely high, that are kind of processed and released over time and at a slower rate. And these are going to be the foods that we consider lower in the glycemic index. And the foods that are going to cause that spike in your blood sugar would be those that are high. So knowing the glycemic index for the carbohydrates you eat can help you to fine tune the meals and keep your blood sugar within a normal range. So what is it exactly? So this glycemic index, or the GI index, is a rating system where foods are ranked on a scale based from 1 to 100 based on how much they raise your blood sugar. And this, you know, most of the foods that are going to be higher on this list are going to be your processed foods such as candy, bread, cake, cookies. All of these have really high GI values, whilst whole foods, this is your unrefined grains, your non-starchy vegetables, and your fruits tend to have a lower GI. So even though some fruits have more sugar, if you eat them in moderation, you'll find that they actually moderate your sugar pretty well. And so you do want to keep some fruit inside of your diet. So carbohydrates with a lower GI value are digested better by the body, they're better absorbed, they're metabolized much better, and they have a slow increase in sugar. So they have a high GI counterparts, right? So they more slowly counteract those effects. They typically cause a lower or a slower rise in your blood sugar and subsequently your insulin levels as well. And that's what you want, because you don't want to develop diabetes, or you don't want your diabetes to be uncontrolled. So those foods that are going to be lower in your glycemic index are the ones that aren't going to elevate your sugar to the point where you have to release a lot of insulin all the time. So how do we measure this value? The index values are created by a vigorous testing process where they take 10 people and they each give them about 50 grams of the same type of food or carbohydrate, and they measure that against the standard of how much it would take to process regular sugar. And they compare them, and then they come out with values for these persons, and they average them out of the people that took it. So the GI value for the test food is then calculated by dividing the glucose area underneath the curve and the food that is being referenced. So the final GI value is an average of those 10 people and how their blood sugars reacted compared to just taking in raw sugar. So ultimately, the GI value is the average person's blood sugar response to a specific carbohydrate. Note that the individual responses may vary on other factors. And so GI can be broken down into three ranges. You have the low GI, which would be 55 or less, medium, which is 56 to 69, high, which is 70 to 100. So that's how we would rate the different foods, low, medium, or high. And we'll talk about, because you can find these scales, and we tend to give these to our new diabetics or our diabetic patients who are struggling with their diet, just so they can see that sometimes some of the things even they think that are really healthy might be actually the things that are spiking their sugar. So it's really good to look into this. So for example, rice milk has a high GI of 86, whilst brown rice, which has lots and lots of fiber, has a medium GI of 66. So in that case, you see that that food, which is processed and without fiber, actually causes a higher spike in sugar than a food that is more natural and it has a lot of fiber in it. And we can also compare the GI or the glycemic index to the glycemic load. So some people don't like the way that the GI system works. And they feel like it doesn't take into account how food is being eaten or its other nutritional qualities or lack thereof. So the GI just kind of gives you an idea of how it spikes, but then also people want to keep in consideration that you have to have moderation in terms of foods that are going to be nutritious for you and provide other nutrients and vitamins that you're going to need. So by taking a broader look, they look at the glycemic load. In other words, you need proteins, you need fats, you need vitamins, you need minerals and antioxidants. And some of those foods are going to be maybe moderate on the GI scale, so you still would have to include them in your diet. And GI looks specifically at the carb count. It's based on a diet around these numbers, means that you would be ignoring a lot of foods that could be helpful to you. And to determine the true health value of food, we have to look a little bit more deeply. So you don't want to just look at those foods and create your entire diet, but you do want to be aware of those foods that are going to spike your glucose and your insulin. So to counter those quantity issues, researchers developed what we call a glycemic load measurement, which accounts for the quantity of the food being eaten And it looks at both the quality of the food and the quantity of the carbs. So you want to have that combination when you're making food choices, at the quality of the food and the quantity. And so the glycemic load is calculated by multiplying the GI value by the number of carbohydrates, then dividing by 100. For example, if you have an apple and it has a GI of 40 and it contains 15 grams of carbs, you'd have 40 times 15 over 100, which would give you 6. So the glycemic load of an apple would be 6. And so low glycemic load would be 10 or less, medium would be 11 to 19, and high would be 20 or more. So if you're looking at, you know, changing up your diet, you might want to incorporate some of these things in the way that you look at foods that you choose. And so what are the benefits of this? Since it's the carbohydrates in food that raise your blood sugar, understanding your GI can help you figure out the foods that are best for your glucose management. Among the benefits when you're planning your meals is it helps you to be more mindful of your carb choices without fully restricting or severely limiting your intake. And if you aim for a low GI diet, you'll naturally be focusing on whole grains, fruits, vegetables, legumes, as opposed to the higher GI end of the spectrum, which includes more processed foods. And we need to get away from that. We heard Dr. Grant talking about how we have to think about what we do with our health so that we don't end up on dialysis or with kidney disease and these types of things. Depending on your health goals, following GI-based diet might mean that you are able to rely less on standard dieting measures such as calorie counting or regimented portion control. So if you're eating the foods that are better for you and are not causing you to have these spikes in sugar, you don't have to always calorie count or restrict your diet so much. And by simply being more mindful of your carb choices rather than severely limiting them, it can be more sustainable and long-term compared to more restrictive diets. And, you know, people complain a lot about dieting and stuff, but we really should be making lifestyle adjustments. And this is one of those ways by kind of looking more at the quality and the quantity of the food at the same time. All right. So, like I said, you don't want to depend on just carbohydrate or the GI index completely, because there's a number of factors to take in, but it does become one of the important things. So the American Diabetes Association states that carbohydrates amounts are available insulin may be the most important factors influencing blood sugar response after eating and should be considered when developing any type of eating plan. The most reliable way to assess your body is affected by certain foods is to test your blood sugar 2 hours after a meal. For most people, an ideal blood sugar result is less than 180 milligrams per deciliter 2 hours after eating a meal. So what does this mean? They're saying if you want to know, or if you're trying to figure out if a specific food, especially if you're already a diabetic, is causing you to have a spike in your sugar, you want to test your blood sugar about 2 hours after you eat and see if you're going over 180 and even above 200, sometimes we look at, but you want 180 will tell you if you're on the higher side. So if you're seeing higher numbers after you eat a particular meal, you can know that that meal was high in carbohydrates. It was probably spiked your sugar quite a bit. And that means you had a large release of insulin or, you know, would be affected by that food. And for most people, that is the ideal kind of thing to do. And if you're not sure what your target or blood sugar is, you should discuss it with your physician. So when in doubt, go and speak with your doctor, and this will give you an idea of what you should be doing. So we're going to open the phone lines in case there are any questions, and then we're going to look at specifically some of those foods that may be causing these increases and which foods are actually going to be lower on the glycemic index. So 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. So we're going to open the phone lines and then we're going to look at some of these foods. So one of the ones that comes in extremely high is white potato, and that has about let's say a medium-sized potato has about 34 grams of carbohydrates, and it ranges anywhere between your GI or your glycemic index of 56 to over 100. And the average GI of a white potato is high. It's in the 80s. So white potato is actually one of your highest glycemic index foods, right? So if you look at a sweet potato, there's a little bit less carbs, and it's kind of a little further down between 47 to 78 on the GI range, and averaging at about 61. So you can see a sweet potato actually has a better rating than a white potato. If you go down the line of vegetables, especially vegetables with carbohydrates, you see like a cup of carrots, it's gonna be a lot less carbohydrates at 6, and it's gonna range between 16 to 92, and that's gonna average around 47. Green peas, carbohydrates around 11, and that's averaging about 48. Apples, because you wanna get some fruit in there, about a medium apple is about 15 carbs, and so that GI rate is about 40. Remember, we said that foods that are below 55 are going to be in your GI range, and these are the foods that you want to really kind of focus on. A banana, which is going to be a bit higher than the apple, it's got about 27 grams of carbohydrates. And it's averaging about a GI or glycemic index of 58. So more higher than the apple, that's gonna be kind of in the medium range. And we tell a lot of our diabetics, if you're gonna have bananas, you may wanna break it in half, have like a half serving. And you can do that with most of your fruits, but you do wanna have fruits inside of your diet. We look at something like white bread, which one slice would be about 14 grams of carbs. And that's coming in about 72. And what people don't realize is that whole wheat bread is not much different. So that's about 12 carbohydrates, and that's coming in at about 72. So still in the moderate to high range in terms of your glycemic index. So this is where the concept of the carb load comes in, looking at a broader sense of nutrient value. So you do know that the wheat bread would be a little bit more nutritious. So if you did have to do one of those, the whole grain bread would probably be better. Caller, you're on the air.
Good night, Dr. D.
Hi, how you doing?
Yeah, you know, I enjoyed the first half hour of the show with the doctor, right?
Yes.
I really enjoyed it, but she scared me, right? Because I have what they dub a simple kidney cyst, right? Mm-hmm. So God make me so complex. I also had a problem with that problem, calling it simple, right? And I always read up on what possibly caused it. So I had BPH at one point in time. And so it speaks about the dilation of the renal tubular systems, right? And the effects of that. And so with the fluid being built up, et cetera, but I really, you know, I guess I could get a contact number for her and maybe go and see her, right? But it didn't bother me. I knew about this from maybe about 10 years ago now, right? But I had a real integral question for her, but I want to comment on what you're speaking about this glycemic index, right? Sure. The thing is, with the glycemic index, I've come to realize that in a way, like, I look at vegetables, like, people talk about the starch. You know, starch is broken down into sugar, right? But the thing is, I have a problem with accepting the norm because that is a vegetable. So I think it is being overrated as being the causes of diabetes. I figure refined sugars are more responsible.
No. So that's why we talk about the glycemic index, because you want to know which one of those types of starch are going to be the ones to push your sugar up.
Yeah, but I know the sweet potatoes are actually better because...
So when you look, processed versus natural carbohydrates are going to be... the natural carbohydrate is always going to win, right? Yeah, They're always going to be better for you.
And the thing is, right, what I realize is that the body actually, when the body is depleted of sugar, carbohydrates, the body will then turn into fat, and then the body will also turn into protein through glucogenesis, which in the body breaks down protein and sugar as a last alternative. But the doctor you had on intrigued me so much. This is why I keep reading. You see, the greatest knowledge is when you realize how ignorant you are, and that's me. I'm very ignorant. You understand me saying, Dr. D? So people don't understand that. They get offended because you display a little bit of knowledge, but they don't understand. That's my greatest knowledge, that I realize my own ignorance. And so I realized that after I was listening to the doctor just now, and she said that the kidneys plays a role in the manufacturing of white blood cells. And I've been reading the immune system, and I didn't ever come across that literature. So what also intrigued me was the fact that the liver has over 500 functions. So my mind was like, wow, you don't want to know it all. You understand me, Dr. D? I'm saying that I just read that the was 400. Some people say 400, but they say the liver have about 500 functions. So you really think a doctor knows it all? This is why you only listen to specialists in certain disciplines, because there's no way a doctor could convince me that he could go out of his discipline and then tell me everything. That's just an example right there. The liver have over 500 functions, they say, as far as on a molecular level. You see what I'm saying, Dr. D? And so, and in listening to the nephrologist, right? And you know, I remember the glomerulus and the glomerulus filtrate from high school, and I know what it does. And so the kidneys absorb and reabsorb. So I wanted to ask her, we know it plays a role in high blood pressure, et cetera, because it absorbs and reabsorbs calcium, potassium, and sodium, et cetera, according to how they lay in the blood and the cells, intra and extracellular fluid movements. But an integral question I wanted to ask her was, most of us like to go on these intermittent fasting and these fasting. And so I've learned that when the body doesn't get normal carbohydrates and it turns to protein and the adipose tissue, which is fatty tissue, and it breaks them down, you get a more toxic effect when these chemicals are broken down. So I wanted to know what role this particular, with starvation or the fasting would play in the toxicity level of the kidneys. Because I know when I had my kidney problem after the surgery, it was not that I had a kidney problem, it's just that my blood pressure was low, so it was not enough pressure to even make the kidney function normal. So they told me to stay off all proteins, even though I didn't believe it, but I just was off the fish and all animal proteins, etc. You know, plant proteins, very few of them are complete. And if they are, you use them in combination with another to make complete proteins. This is how much reading I've been doing. I listened to a nutritionist online show today, and they are learned, but they don't know it all, because I keep reading, and I found out that certain foods have histamine, and certain foods have prostaglandins, and these foods cause more inflammatory response in a viral infection or a bacterial infection. So the foods in itself can cause a more pro or anti-inflammatory response. And you know, nutrition is quite complex. She might be a doc, but I was reading nutritional books for about 30 years. I'm 57. So I always have a lot of input, and I always believe in reading and keep reading and reading. I don't give up on a certain paradigm. You see what I'm saying, doctor?
Yeah.
And this is what it is. And so I really would have liked a contact for the lady, because I have, like I said, I have a simple kidney cyst. They say it wouldn't bother me. It hasn't bothered me yet, but I also, you know, because the UN...
So check Renal House. That's where you can find her. And like she said, they're also on Facebook, and I'm sure you can just kind of look them up. She didn't give the number, but Renal House is really easy to find. It's easy name. Where you can find Dr. Grant Taylor.
Yeah, so my doctor did warn me of the side effects, and I did read up on the repercussions of the PPH. You see, so all of these interplay with one another, but I listened to the information that she gave. So, you know, I'll just finish it back and enjoy this one, all right? Yeah. You have a good night, doctor.
All right, sure, no problem. Yeah, so you did bring up some key points about starvation and reduction. It would be good to get Dr. Grant's opinion on that. It has a lot to do with the degree of starvation as well. And if you're going into ketosis, that's a whole other story. So, you know, I think at the end, you do need to have some balance of what you're doing. And any type of extreme diet that you're going to do, you're going to have to sit down with your physician and really kind of go through that, because you made a good point that nutrition is very, very complex, and our bodies are very complex, and we do need to have certain things in our body to function properly. I find like anything that's really off is going to cause a problem. And I think with a lot of, especially because I talked about keto before, and there's some good and there's some bad and everything. Sometimes when you're out of balance, you have to go the other way to kind of clear some of those things. And it can be an extremely, extremely tricky situation. So you don't want to do something like that on your own. You want to have advice. So just before we're all done, and or if we have time, we can take another caller if another one's there. But we're just going to finish off that list so that you have an idea of what we're talking about. And you can get these lists online. You can check out the glycemic index on various foods if you have some questions. And like I said, we try to provide this kind of with our new diabetics or our patients who are struggling with some of their diet, just so that they can look at this. You kind of give them a handout. And so kind of oatmeal, not instant. So this is the oatmeal that you would mix, because I know a lot of people eat oats as in terms of health-wise. There's about 27 carbs and about half a cup of dried oatmeal. And the glycemic index is between 42 to 75. So about low to medium. So, you know, the oats are going to be something that's not going to really rise your blood sugar a lot, depending on how much you eat. And so the amount of these foods that you eat is also something you have to think about. When we look at brown rice compared to white rice, we find that they have a similar carb level, but they have slightly different glycemic indexes. So you're going to find that brown rice is a little bit better, between 37 and 87, coming in at about 66. And then that's going to be about moderate. And then you have your white rice, which is a little bit higher, which is between 43 and 94, coming in at about 72. So we can see that the brown rice is going to be slightly better at not pushing up your sugar as much. So if you're going to eat rice, you know, you find that the brown rice is going to be, and any foods that are like high in fiber that require you to break down the food more inside of your body is going to probably be lower on the glycemic index. So that is why processed food is tend to be worse for you, because it's usually the raw sugar component and that goes straight into your bloodstream. If we look at pasta, we can see that pasta comes in about 43, just a little bit less than rice when you're talking about one cup of pasta. And pasta actually has a lower glycemic index than your brown rice and your white rice. And so it comes in about between 40 and 60 or 50 on average, which actually puts pasta as on the lower, closer to the lower side of your glycemic index. So you're going to find that having a bit of pasta is going to be a little bit better for your blood sugar spikes, even than some brown rice. So those are some of the major foods that we wanted to talk about, and kind of wrapping it all up. You have to be kind of vigilant about the foods that you put into your body, because all of these things interact and create our health environment, and we have to have some balance. So if you're concerned about your health, like Dr. Grant Taylor mentioned earlier, reach out to your physician, get a checkup today and see where you are, so you can start preserving the health that you have or improving the health that you have. And that is really the key for tonight's topic. You can look up the GI index, or if you're one of our patients that comes into our office, you can ask for a copy of the foods related to glycemic index, and we would have a handout for you, and you can keep that on you as you're doing your shopping and when you're making your food choices. So we are done. You know, these 1 hour shows go really, really fast. We want to thank everybody for listening tonight on Guardian 96.9, the Doctors In with me, Dr. Janotha Archer, and brought to you by Medical Concierge Services. You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, as well as our website, mcsfamilymedicine.com. And we will see you all next week for another exciting show. Good night.